Welcome to the ISF Podcast from the Information Security Forum. The ISF Podcast is hosted by ISF CEO Steve Durbin, and every episode he brings listeners features timely conversations, practical insights, and resources for global cybersecurity professionals. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. In today's episode, longtime friend of ISF Nick Witchell is in conversation with Steve about a wide range of topics, from the war in Ukraine, cyber preparedness and cyber resilience in business, the role of governments in regulation, and more. Here's Nick.
Steve, a challenging landscape as ever, both economically and with a developing and escalating war, of course, in Ukraine. A very aggressive President Putin in Russia. Now, in cyber terms, how concerning should we be finding this?
I think very is the short answer, Nick. I think that what we have seen here is an evolution, if you like, of warfare. Now, from an ISF standpoint, we have talked for quite some while through things like our Threat Horizon series about the way in which warfare is going cyber. And indeed, in our latest edition, we've come out much more strongly and do a session on cyber warfare. So why is that? Because we're so heavily dependent upon technology. You can make a very significant impact on world economies, supply chains, all of the things upon which we've become so dependent through the use of cyber. And that's why we're seeing this increase, I think, in cyber attacks, in very targeted as well attacks on, say, banking systems. There's concern at the moment about the midterm US elections, whether or not they're going to be targeted. And so really, we've just got, I think, a blending that we're never going to see going away now between cyber warfare and what I suppose people would call traditional warfare.
It all comes down to a subject we've discussed many times, and that is the preparedness of companies and institutions. What is your impression? Are businesses evolving quickly enough to deal with this changing threat landscape?
I think businesses are evolving, yes. Are they evolving quickly enough? That's a really tough one, because I think it depends so much on which sector you happen to be in. It depends on the risk profile that ultimately a board of directors is comfortable with, and so therefore is willing to invest and so on. But I would say certainly over the last 18 months, 24 months, companies have really stepped up in terms of understanding the potential threat, understanding the need for increased resilience, so the ability to recover from whatever is thrown at them from a cyber perspective. And I think we're starting to see a lot more boards of directors asking pertinent questions around cyber profile. Are we ready for an attack that might happen? Are we equipped to deal with and respond to, for instance, ransomware? So I think that the level of awareness has increased, and I think therefore the level of preparedness is increasing. But is it going fast enough? Probably not.
I guess it's never going fast enough.
That's
but
right.
It's encouraging, I sense, that you're talking about the level of resilience, the level of knowledge amongst board members is increasing. I mean, and is that across all the sectors, do you think?
I think it is. I think that certainly our traditional critical infrastructure sectors have led the way. They've always done that because they were always the most attractive for attack, of course. But there have been a number of attacks that have taken place that have really, I think, encouraged people to look at cyber in a much more realistic fashion than they had done in the past. So we've had attacks that have impacted supply chains in particular. So petrol supply chains, food supply chains. And so that has really brought it home to people. It's made it much more personal, whereas I think the danger we ran in the past was it was just bits and bytes, wasn't it? You know, we weren't really impacted to it. It was just some other poor, unfortunate company that had lost data.
And yet, despite all of this, despite the ISF's efforts, companies, organizations are still being hit, in particular, by ransomware attacks. Now, I'm tempted to ask, why is that? Why is it still happening?
I think the reality of it is that, and this is the piece that I think a lot of people have struggled to come to terms with. The reality is that if an attacker is serious and has his or her eye on your organization, there is actually very little that you can do. A sophisticated attacker will be able to breach your defenses. And this is why I talk so much about the need to respond, to get businesses back up and running, to protect the data that's most important to you. That's a fundamental piece, I think, now in any cyber strategy. To ransomware itself, We've seen that evolving, of course. I've talked in the past, you know, about things like crime as a service, where you can go and buy particular pieces of malware. Well, that's where ransomware is evolving to as well. So that's opening up the market potential for the cyber criminal, transitioning from needing to be an expert to being more of a learner, if you like. And of course, the ability to then drop a ransomware attack, again, isn't really that difficult. You know, we've seen increases in phishing, we've seen increases in whaling, we've seen increases generally in the way in which systems are being attacked. And ransomware has become, I think, something of the malware of choice. Whether or not that continues, it's still up there, you know, in the top two or three attacks. Certainly it is something, again, back to this level of understanding that boards now do relate to. They do ask questions around, you know, if that were to happen to us, how would we respond? What would the impact be? But again, certainly from our perspective, when we look forward and look at the threat landscape, we think that that's going to be around for at least a good couple of years.
We've talked about the role of individual businesses, of boards of directors. We'll come back to the role of the ISF in just a moment. Mm. But what about governments, particularly here in Europe? Are governments, broadly speaking, stepping up to the mark? What is their role in all of this?
Yeah, that's an interesting one, really. And I've been, I think, probably a little critical in the past about the role of government. I mean, I think I have some fairly clear-cut views, personal views, on the role that government has to play. And for me, it's about really setting out clear guidance on legislation, on regulation, and then standing behind those rules, if you like, that have been set in place. Because the one thing that businesses really don't like is uncertainty. You know, if you can be really clear about the tram lines within which you operate, then life becomes simpler. You may not agree with it. That's a different discussion. But at least you know where you stand. And I think the challenge that businesses are facing now is that we all operate across so many different jurisdictions. And we've got this evolving regulatory landscape that is constantly changing. And that is raising a real challenge for businesses to try to understand where these tram lines are in the different countries in which they're operating. But for me, the role of government is to set those tram lines. And particularly in Europe, I think, to collaborate around those so that we've got consistency.
And do you see encouraging signs that there is this collaboration? I mean, governments surely must understand that this is a serious threat. So why is it that they are not achieving the degree of collaboration that you are seeking?
Well, I think they've made some good progress with the GDPR, for instance. I think that was a really positive step forward. I think that the way in which that was brought about with consultation, you know, it was never perfect. And so I think there is some alarm amongst the security sector anyway, in the UK, for instance, when we hear talk of perhaps UK government moving away from that or creating its own. And the question has to be, well, why? Why does one particular government think it can do better than, you know, a sort of a conglomerate that have come together with these things? So I think that for me is the way forward. We have to have much more collaboration amongst governments to come up with legislation that operates across jurisdiction that, again, as I said earlier, is clear. And there has to be the will to do that because these things are not easy. You know, I'm stating the obvious. But once you get into that sort of debate and discussion at government level, then you need to settle yourself down for a fairly long ride.
Let's talk about one case with big implications. This is the Uber case in the United States. A CISO convicted in that case, a ransom having been paid. And I think it's called into question, what are the limits of responsibility for a CISO? What do you see as the particular implications and the lessons that need to be drawn from this case?
Yeah, I think it is a big case. I mean, clearly everybody is talking about that at the moment. For me, what it is doing is a couple of things. I talked about these tram lines, very clear legislation. What it's demonstrating is that federal courts in the United States, anyway, are prepared to exert the level of influence that's required to really demonstrate that they're serious about those regulations. That, for me, is actually a good thing, because if you're not going to enforce a regulation, what's the point in having it? So that's the first thing I would say. The second thing about it is that, for, I think, a lot of people looking at this from the outside is causing them to sit up a little bit and say, hang on a minute, governments are taking this seriously, CISOs need to be taking this seriously as well, and actually we're now seeing a degree of liability coming in at the personal level, which perhaps we haven't seen before. You know, there's been a lot of discussion around CISOs wanting a seat at the table, wanting to really exercise that chief piece in the title, which means they're an executive director, you know, with all of those responsibilities. So a discussion, I think a healthy one, breaking out as to the role of personal liability in all of these things. But fundamentally, I think what we've seen coming out of that is some legal precedent that says we do have a regulation, we are prepared to enforce it, and so it doesn't matter whether you're a CISO, a CEO, or a defense counsel in any shape or form in an organization, you have to start paying attention to these regulations and you have to fall in line with them. And again, for me, that's a very constructive step forward.
And I sense that quite a number of CISOs will be concerned by this case. Yeah. Is it reasonable for them to be seeking greater safeguards regarding their own personal liability from their company or their organization, do you think?
I think it is. And I think, again, that's a healthy discussion to be having, because you want to have those conversations, don't you, before the day. You know, the day to be having it is not when it's just happened. So I think it is, you know, shining a bit of a light on that. I think that a number of CISOs may decide that actually the job probably isn't for them. And that would be a very sad day, because I think we've seen for some while now increasing stress levels, workload increasing, particularly for CISOs. And for some, I do fear that perhaps this may be the final straw. But on the positive side, again, you know, if you want a seat at the table, then these are the sorts of things that you have to really get your arms around and buy into. And I think that it's a reflection on the maturing of the industry, on the maturing of the role. And I would like to think that for many CISOs, once the dust has settled a little bit and people are able to really analyze exactly what the courts were saying, it will provide a degree of guidance as to what is acceptable versus not acceptable.
We've talked about current threats. In broad terms, how do you see threats evolving as we go forward?
I think we will see, unfortunately, increased sophistication. I do think that we're going to see perhaps more technology-based threats. I mean by that artificial intelligence starting to come into the mix. I think that crime as a service will continue to flourish. I think that on the positive side, organizations now understand that cyber is actually central to the business strategy. So you can't have a discussion about how you're going to evolve your business, grow it, deliver shareholder value, and ignore the cyber component. So if you look at it on the maturity curve, then cyber is reaching that sort of post-teenage stage, if I could put it that way. But unfortunately, it's being driven down that road by an increase in cybercrime, which I think is just a fact of life.
Yet, within this complex network of threats and so on, it is still the case, is it not, that very often the individual human being is perceived as the weak link in it all. Now, should we be rebalancing the message and emphasizing more that the individual actually is our strongest asset?
I think we should. I really get quite annoyed when people talk to me about the fact that, you know, people are the weakest link. They're not the weakest link. They do have the potential to be the strongest. As an organization, what I think is required is an increase in the level of awareness, an increase in the level of training and education, an investment in people to take into account the different environments in which people are now working. So, you know, very few organizations have gone entirely back into an office-based environment. We've still got this hybrid, which is going to be with us, I think, for a very long time to come. And so there is a need to increase that level of support and awareness so that we can combat some of the increase in cybercrime we've just been touching on. And I think that people do have the ability to make the difference. I was talking to a chief information security officer about a particular breach that he'd been handling. And one of the things that he highlighted was he'd been surprised at the fact that some of the investment he'd made in technology hadn't been able to either prevent the breach happening or at least help him to solve some of those problems. And so in his words, he'd had to fall back on his security people. Well, falling back on these security people in reality meant that they were working ridiculous hours to bring the systems back up, handing over through follow the sun. And I think that, as I was talking to him, the light bulb eventually sort of went on and said, well, hang on a minute. If I'm really in a hole, what am I going to rely on? My technology or my people? And the answer, 9 times out of 10, if not 10 out of 10, is the people. because they will find a way to bring the systems back that you've lost. And machines won't do that. And I think that is the point that we have to keep really top of mind when we talk about weak links versus strong links.
Something really that should not be forgotten. Finally, how is the ISF helping its members to deal with these many challenges?
In a number of ways, Nick. I mean, we're continuing with what I think is a very rich program of research. That's important so that members understand exactly what's going on in the space. We've invested significantly over the last couple of years in our software ability. So at our Congress in Manchester in November, we're launching our new supplier web app. So really trying to zone in on the problem of supply chains and how to manage so many different suppliers. So we've invested in that. We continue, of course, to build all of these tools on the back of the Standard of Good Practice, which is now a world-leading reference document. You can map to ISO, you can map to NIST, a number of other different standards that are out there. And then the other thing that we're continuing to do, and this is the piece that I really would like to encourage our members to make much more use of, is we're opening up access to our analysts very much more, to our consultants, to help actually deal with some of these very tangible issues on the ground, in the moment, through some of the services that we can provide. And my hope is that we'll continue to do that over the coming years. We are a not-for-profit. We are member-driven. So everything that we do is geared around trying to help our members and respond to their needs. And I think that's a really good place to be.
Steve, a pleasure as ever. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Nick.
We'll be back with a new episode in a week. In the meantime, as always, we ask that you take 10 seconds to pull up this podcast on whatever device you're listening and give us a 5-star rating. If you have a little more time, you can even write a quick review. That helps other listeners who might enjoy our content find us. And we also want to make sure to introduce you to the ISF Analyst Insight podcast, which goes in depth on the hottest topics in information security. In every episode, ISF analysts hand-select active security professionals from ISF member organizations to discuss how the implementation of ISF research is uniquely applied to their real-world context. We hope you'll listen, and of course, we'll put a link to that show in our show notes. If there's a topic or a question that you'd like us to cover in a future episode, let us know at securityforum.org. Which is also where you can find our catalog of past video and podcast episodes, as well as ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance related to discussions like today's. The ISF podcast is produced by TalkBox and Tavia Gilbert, with music by Alexander Filipiak, senior producer Katie Flood, mix and master by Kayla Elrod. Thanks for listening.